Welcome to Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast. My name is Ed Charbonneau. I am an artist whose main focus is on painting, and I am also an adjunct faculty member in the Fine Arts Department at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. This podcast presents a series of conversations about color, color usage, and optics as they relate to theories of human color perception in the making of visual art and design. Hello, welcome to today's episode with interviewing Gamma Jean. This episode is not exactly typical of prior episodes, given that it isn't as specifically about concepts of color theory that I've discussed. It's not a deep dive into that realm of history and what may or may not be going on inside of our minds when we're making things or the various topics that I've covered. So for those of you who are listening to this podcast, for that, you know, kind of informed view into my research, you're not going to find it as much in this episode. Although it was very enjoyable speaking with Gamma Jean. So I'm running it anyway because it does tie in with a broader concept that I've been trying to understand and trying to articulate about how our approach to color as makers can be intuitive. It can be very conceptual or based in theory of sorts, or it can just seemingly come from an unknown space, and it's something that we react to, and we just like those colors, so we use them. And part of my mission with this podcast is to try to claim that all of those approaches are valid. And from the very technical to the very researched to the, I just like these colors and so I'm going to make something with it, and that they have responses. I think that idea has been borne out in some of these interviews where, like, Luann Stovall described a class that she gave a questionnaire to, and the simple question was, what is your favorite color? And one of the students replied back that it was blue and green. And then getting further into it, like, well, what shade of blue and green, and so forth and so on, to later learn that the student shares with Luann that the reason it's the green is the grass and the blue is the sky, and the reason those are his favorite colors is because the person's grandfather would visit every once in a while, and during those visits, they would sit under a tree on the grass and look up at the sky, and it's just a super fond memory for this person. So that particular palette resonates deeply with that person. Then on the other side of things, another interview with Jeremy Shapinski, a landscape painter who says that he hates the color green. So we have, you know, somebody who's working in the landscape, which is largely very green and lush when he's out there painting, and yet he despises this color. And even Suyao Tian, you know, spoke about, as a young person, collecting things and collaging materials on her wall, removing the faces so that she was just creating an abstraction of color way before she understood what it all meant. It was just kind of going with what she was drawn to. And so I think that there's a lot of validity in that, and that's why I wanted to have those interviews. And I was, you know, hoping that those ideas would come forward, as well as a bunch of other topics concerning the subjects that we're talking about. So yes, so when I sat down with Jean to interview her before we even started recording, I said, well, this is a color theory podcast. And the first thing that she said was, well, what's that? So it's like, all right. This is not a deep dive into color theory like some of our, like I said. But there are some things here that I just really think are worth focusing on, for me personally, in my whole journey of discovery on this path. And then another interesting thing, though, too, is during the interview, she speaks about going to the University of Minnesota to major in art in after World War II in the late 1940s. And she dropped out in the early 1950s to take a job with a department store downtown Minneapolis, where she worked with a team. Sounded like a small team, so she had a lot of independence and a lot of control. But this team made the store designs and the layouts for the products. So early 1950s, downtown Minneapolis. It didn't come up in the interview, the name of the store, the department store, but it was Dayton's department store. And people from the Twin Cities area of Minnesota and stuff will recognize the Dayton's name. Dayton's evolved into Macy's, or Macy's bought Dayton's, I believe, maybe in the 90s. And part of the Target Corporation, like, split off of Dayton's. So once upon a time, I believe Target was owned by the Dayton Corporation. One of the key things that was happening back then was that the Dayton family had commissioned an architect named Victor Gruen to design the first indoor shopping mall, which came to be known as Southdale, and it's located in Edina, Minnesota, which is part of the Twin Cities metro area. It's just on the southern, it's south of Minneapolis, basically. It's a first-tier suburb of Minneapolis. And Southdale opened up in 1956. So Jean was working with store layout during the time that Southdale was being planned and constructed and ultimately opened. And that's very curious to me. During the interview, I did not put two and two together to ask her specifically about what it was like working there. I mean, she talks about how she loved making these displays, and it sounds like I said, that she had a lot of freedom and big budgets, so they were able to basically make whatever they wanted with these elaborate stored designs, which I believe has evolved into the modern day shopping experience. These are some of the seeds, I think, in my research. So Southdale became the great grandfather for the modern indoor shopping mall. Victor Gruen went on to design many other shopping malls, and I believe he did. But I know a lot of competitors built many, many shopping malls all over the world based on this model. And there's an interesting thread that I've been following. I haven't done a podcast about it, but out of this development of Southdale is this concept of store design and layout that's referred to as the Gruen transfer, and it's named after Victor Gruen. And I won't go into it a lot here, but I will do an episode on this because it's been a fascination of mine for many years, and as it ties into color theory. So color is a sensory experience, as is sound and smell and taste and touch. All of these things are impacting the way that we're interpreting the world. And so color is the focus of this podcast. And so color is my interest in how this works within a store design and this history of this guy, Victor Gruen, because Southdale is a store with purposely no outdoor windows in a controlled environment. They did have skylights, so there was daylight coming in, I believe. But they controlled, it was purposely set up to control all sensory experience in a way. And this idea that started off as a utopian kind of vision of this Gruen guy had grown up in Vienna, and he came to the United States after the war, and he was sad that American cities were losing their downtowns and main hubs of community gathering that were the squares in Vienna, where various businesses and restaurants would locate around one common space. And so he attempted to make that in Edina, and hence the hub design of stores, and I could go into it. But this idea of the Gruen transfer was kind of maligned. It's like designers realize the power of this, and the theory is that it has been used to create what's referred to as scripted disorientation, to create the atmosphere for more impulse buying. It took his utopian ideas of community gathering space and turned it into a way to extract more money out of the shoppers. And if you're interested in this, I'll put a link in the show notes here. There's a really good essay or story in The New Yorker from Malcolm Gladwell in 2004, I believe, called The Terrazzo Jungle. It describes Victor Gruen's life and what I'm talking about. And the way I heard about this idea of a Gruen transfer was when I was in Australia. There's a show, I don't know if it's still running, but it's this awesome show called The Gruen Transfer. And it's on ABC, which is the Australian version of PBS or the BBC. And it's basically a panel talk show where the hosts invite marketing executives and advertising executives in Australia to review and critique current advertisements, either film or print or what's on TV and stuff like that. And it's hilarious, like that they really go into this stuff about how these messages are communicating to an audience. And they have a book that's published called The Gruen Transfer, and in it, Will Anderson, one of the hosts. That's where I got the word scripted disorientation, was a quote from Anderson. So on that note, there's stuff happening, and this is a great episode with Jean talking about their life. She's been making things for 90 years. Her first art object was as a three-year-old, and so we can all identify with that, probably having made things when we were little kids. And she just talks about the journey that she's been on. And it was great talking with her, so I appreciate this opportunity to share our conversation with you. Today's podcast is a special edition to honor one of our senior citizens. One of my production managers volunteers with senior citizens. And while volunteering, she found an absolute treasure by the name of Gamma Jean. Gamma Jean is 93 years old and began creating artworks at the age of 3 when she fashioned a tiny doll bib as her first creation, which is framed and hanging in her room. So basically, Gamma Jean has been creating many forms of art designs for 90 years and states that she's not done yet. From making her small bib to currently putting finishing touches on special pieces, Gamma Jean's 93 years have definitely been productive. Gamma Jean attended the University of Minnesota as an art major with an art history minor in 1949 through the 50s. Or do we have an exact date?
Probably 51, I don't know.
Nice. Gamma Jean received several service recognition awards through the years. One of significance was personally given to her by Hubert Humphrey in the 9th grade when she was 15 years old. Gamma Jean has always been centered on service projects for several organizations throughout the community. Never a dull moment while being married 67 years, raising a family of 4 children, has 12 grandchildren and 22 great-grandchildren. Many of her artworks were part of her service projects for the community at large. She is a master in needlework, paintings, oil and acrylic and watercolor, pencil sketching, murals, and displays for local malls and department stores, basket weaving, creating program covers for special fundraising events, hand painting, decorating furniture, and a very special dashboard design for her friend who owned a Crosley automobile in the 1950s. Let me not forget to mention that she did many sewing projects for herself and others, including knitting Argyle socks for her current boyfriend of the day. Did men's tailoring. Made women's clothes and alterations for bridal shops, and even created and knitted her own wedding dress. With that, I welcome Gamma Jean to the podcast. Thank you for taking the time to have this conversation.
I'm so grateful that you are interviewing me because it's given me a chance to meditate on my history, which is really sweet. But you've already mentioned everything, and we could stop the podcast, but we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
And because this is something new to me, I have the habit of starting a new project, but first thanking God for my hands and my eyes, which I've used tirelessly for so many years, the pleasure it's given me. So I thank you for bringing it up again.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. And yeah, I'm very curious, like you mentioned that you were at the University of Minnesota in 1949 through 51, majoring in art. And I guess I'm curious about that time, like the types of classes that you took. And because this is like a color theory podcast, do you recall or were there instruction that stayed with you regarding like color usage or your approach to using color in your artworks?
No. But I had a communications class, which was helpful and interesting, and health classes, geology, all sorts of things that I wouldn't have been curious about, but helped me in my long-term experience of coming across things that I had heard about and learned about.
Yeah.
And I also took art classes at that time.
Yeah.
Every semester I had art of some sort. Are we into art yet, or?
Yeah.
Or do you want the university thing here?
Well, you were a practicing artist before you went to school, like from a very young age. It sounds like you were making things.
Well, if you want to go back there, I can.
Yeah.
And starting with the bib, my father was so impressed with what I did as a three-year-old. I cut out a piece of fabric in the shape of a bib and sewed two or three buttons on, which were pretty poorly sewed on. But he thought it was impressive that I knew how to use a needle, and he saved it and put it in an envelope. And after he died and we were going through things, that's where I found it.
Wow.
And the date was on it, and that's how I know how old I was when I did it. Huh. So maybe my curiosity about fabric and doing things started then. And it did continue. It still continues to this day. But I progressed from there. It was all kids' stuff that I did.
Right. Like making clothes.
That's right.
For your toys.
My father thought I was artistic and knew about classes at the Minneapolis Museum of Fine Art. Mm-hmm. And he said, "How would you like to go on a Saturday?" And I said, "Oh, that sounds like fun." And I went, and it was fun. But I don't remember much that we did because I was pretty young. I was in grade school.
Yeah.
And I felt the things I was doing were rather primitive, but I loved going to the store because they had all that fancy stuff in there that you could use, all kinds of paint and brushes and an easel. I even got to use an easel there.
Wow.
That was big time for me.
Yeah, very professional.
But when those classes ended, then I didn't have any more classes like that for a while. And pursued things within classes that were artistic. We were taught to knit in the sixth grade, And people, all of my classmates, knitted 6-inch squares, which were sent someplace and made into blankets for the men World War II.
Wow.
That's how old I am.
Yeah.
I go way back. But I'm proud. I wouldn't want to be any other age than what I am right now. And yeah. I tell that to elderly people because it's a blessing if you live longer and you can still think and talk to your family. Mm. That's precious. But the interest in making things, doing things with my hands, were productive. Mm. And I always took art classes in middle school and did well there. And when I graduated from middle school, I was given another award for my art. Mm. And I think it was to the Minneapolis School of Art. And then I went to high school. Oh, I loved high school. It was so social. And we had choices. And I took the hard classes, but I always had an art class. And my teacher was exceptional because she had such a variety of things to teach us, starting with putting our left hand out if we drew with our right, to copy our hand, to get that sketching going.
Yeah.
And that was important. But she led us through a lot of different things that we did. A student posed for portraits. We all did a portrait of him. And you would kind of guess who it was.
Yeah.
Some you could tell. And she also came on to new paints, which she hadn't experienced, the acrylics.
Right.
And she said, if you want to do like you would do an oil painting and try the acrylics, she would help us get started. Well, that sounded fascinating.
Wow.
So I did a family portrait of myself and my three sisters. And I must say, it looked good to me. And my mother hung that up in the living room. But then I needed a frame that size, so I took the picture off, and I think it was discarded because I personally didn't value it like other people had.
Right. Wow.
So
you're very critical of your work.
Well,
early on,
I knew I was doing it mostly for my own pleasure, but I did get the award for the most artistic in ninth grade. Well, then I got to high school and had the opportunity to take art classes every semester, which I did. And because we were given choices, at one time I decided I was going to do fashion drawing and illustrating like they would use in the newspaper, because I saw that.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I did quite a few of those. And my teacher submitted some of my things to a national competition, and the one in the competition was one of my fashion drawings. And I was pleased, but I thought, didn't they like my other things that were more difficult for me? That was easy, and I had fun doing it. When I graduated from high school, out of a class of, I was a midterm class, only 112, but the spring class was over 600.
Wow.
And they combined those two classes in honors.
Okay, yeah.
So the biggest honor at the June class was given to me for my artistic talent. Huh. And I certainly didn't appraise myself that high, but other people did.
Right.
And I did a lot of freelance things for the school. Made 4x8 panels for the homecoming game of football players playing. I would try anything.
Yeah.
And I would say, I'll do it. And it turned out so well that others liked it. But that must have been been referenced to the people that had been teaching me, and that's how I got that nice award.
Yeah, if somebody was teaching you how to draw your hand when you were in 7th and 8th grade, drawing from observation like that.
And then I went to the University of Minnesota because we all went there.
Yeah.
Most of my class, I think. And I thought, well, this is going to be fun. It's even more social. Mm. But I was in art classes and I loved it because of the variety, again, that I had. I was in a class of drawing live models. Mm. Some were dressed and some were undressed. And I thought, well, I'm in college now. I can take a swallow and do this one too.
Yeah.
And we had a sculpting class. But the most excitement I had was meeting an architect. He was going to be an architect. Hmm. We really liked each other and dated each other.
Yeah.
And married each other. And that's where the life began. You said it before, kept house, did all those things you do with family. But I found time to enjoy handwork. And I started doing that again, and that was really important. And I was just doing painting for my own pleasure and sketching for my own pleasure. Got interested in community activities where I was really able to use my artistic talent, because I was ball chairman of a suburban ball, and they had some empty stores where they were holding the ball. Nice boards on the wall, but not decorated. And I painted pictures on those. I started painting pictures there. And I did some painting when I visited in Seattle, Washington, into some homes where they wanted some decorative painting. And it was freehand. Kept busy with that. Then I started a hospital guild. And they had a bazaar at the time. And all the bazaars made things and sold.
Yeah.
And I found a man that had just retired. His wife gave him tools. He didn't know how to use them. But he learned how to use them. And a neighbor said he was making things, even birdhouses. I said, that's a perfect idea for children's, for their fundraiser. I'll talk to him, get birdhouses made, which he did. I hand-painted over 200 birdhouses, not just painting the outside of it, but I decorated it with fences and flowers and birds and also swing hanging from a tree and did things like that. And that was fun. As well as dollhouses, lamps, and things like that I painted. But that was my wood painting mode.
Yeah.
But when people saw that, they were attracted and asked me to paint things for them. So I did a couple of bedroom furniture, toy box. But we lived next door to three boys. The older two went to school many miles away. We lived South Minneapolis, and they were in Dinky Town, I call it. That was the center of the University of Minnesota social place, so they had a high school there. And in order for the boys to get there, their dad bought them a Crosley. And when I brought, they showed me the Crosley, and it was cute as a bug.
Yeah.
Just as cute as could be, and about the size of a bug. But you could, if you squeezed, you could get four people in there. And it was bright colors, and they had been up, oh, I didn't tell you this, but my bedroom, which I did, and seen how I decorated there. So they said, would you like to come and decorate the, what do you call
the
it?
The dashboard.
The dashboard on our Crosley. And I said, oh, yeah, what do you want? Oh, people and animals and trees and things like that. I said, I could do all of that. And I painted that for them, and they drove their Crosley. All fancy, fancy. And it was such a cute little car that at school, kids picked it up out of the street and carried it up the steps. And it was cute. But the reason I got to that point was because we had polio in Minneapolis, and we were trying to, my mother was trying to control us from being any place. The state fair closed down, and Nobody went to the movies. We had to stay indoors. So they wanted to know what we wanted to do. My sister wanted to do what I said. I'm going to remove the wallpaper in the bedroom and paint it. Paint it black. It's got a light pink ceiling. Look great. Windows all around. My father said, well, black's really dark. How about navy blue? I said, oh, navy blue's good. So he gave me the money. I took the streetcar to go get the gallons of paint I needed and painted my walls and then decorated them. So the neighbor boys had seen it and wanted that on their Crosley. Okay. That's how that whole story came. And none of us got polio either. Right. That's the best end of the story.
Oh, that's good.
Did that answer that question?
Yeah.
I think I was too verbose.
Oh, no, it's good background. Well, I mean, to me, and we just met, so it's interesting. Because I kind of grew up, and, you know, my mom can attest to, you know, I drew on my walls in my room. Well, I remember drawing on the window shades. So when they got pulled down, there was like these characters on there. And one of the things I do is paint murals. And so this idea of just painting whatever it is that, you know, I come across, you know, when I see an empty wall, I don't necessarily see it as just a wall or something. I see it as a potential. And it sounds like you've been doing that your whole life. You know, from a really young age.
It's freeing.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, how old? Well, and it's, to me, the idea of wanting to paint your room black. And was this in high school as well?
Or, yes.
Yeah, so that's really
unusual. Well, they even wrote
choice.
About it in the school newspaper. It was so different than anybody else.
Yeah, and especially like since my focus like with this whole podcast project has been on color and why do we make choices like that? To me, that's just really interesting. I don't know. Have you ever thought about it, like what prompted you to want to make that choice of a black room?
Or, no.
Because the pink ceiling? So it had a pink ceiling. That's unusual in and of itself. Most ceilings are not.
Well, it was pink when they bought the house.
Oh, interesting.
It was already pink. I wasn't going to paint a ceiling because we used brushes then. They didn't have rollers.
Right.
Took us all summer long.
Yeah.
And we had a cat hanging by the window, and my mother would say, keep that window closed. Why? Because that cat is there. That cat is named Polio.
Oh.
Don't open the door window.
Oh, man. Yeah. What a terrible, terrifying. Well, pink and black is like a classic combination of colors. If you think back through history, all the different stuff, like from the 1950s especially.
I love color. Yeah. I love color. I eat blue.
Blue,
Tell, I have a lot of blue in my house, and people comment on it, and I say, I eat that color.
Yeah.
I love. And after having... what is the thing you have done to your eyes when you get old?
The cataracts?
Cataracts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The blues were bluer. And I said, this is the biggest treat I could ever have.
Yeah. I've read about that. I think what happens with cataracts is the lens gradually turns yellow. And so it blocks the short wavelengths that we perceive as blue from entering our eyes. And so when they're removed... Did everything seemed like hyper blue for maybe a couple of weeks, right? And then did it kind of normalize back, or is it still?
I'm still hyper when I see blue if it's plastic. Yeah. Just blue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although my next car is going to be lipstick red.
All right.
And it's going to be a convertible.
That's good.
And I'm going to have red leather boots to go with it. And yeah. then people say, well, where are you going? And I say, directly to Target. And they laugh like you.
Yeah. Well, the red, it works. Red and white, there it is.
I love red too.
Yeah. Like, people are artists. Like, if I say I'm an artist and I make paintings, usually that translates into a lot of other things. Like, when I'm stacking the dishes in my dishwasher, I kind of pay attention to, like, what it looks like, you know? And it kind of sounds like you've been doing similar things about, because, like, you could be working on a painting, but then seeing opportunities for, you know, even thinking about the color of the car and your outfit to go with it.
I call it space management.
Space management, yeah.
Space management. And I took a test one time, and I can never remember the name, but they build things, make things, wires, all this kind of stuff. And I seemed to grade the highest in that. Electrician? I don't know.
Yeah.
This is when I was going to go to college. They were trying to discover where to put me.
Yeah. Well, it's like this spatial awareness that it seems like you have. And I can identify with that. I have a way of being able to look at things and, well, I don't know, it's hard to describe. Well, like from a very young, well, when I first painted my first mural, I was 18 years old. And I realized that I could draw something this big and that, like, on a regular sketchbook size, and then draw and paint the same thing, only now, like, 10 feet tall, and not really have to think about it. I could just blow it up in my mind. I've always associated that with, like, having kind of a sensitivity to space itself.
You're a spaceman.
But, yeah, I don't know. Well, it's interesting that you married an architect. And
yes.
Because they're all about space, the work that they do, you know, creating spaces.
Well, he didn't create them, but he created, his talent was selecting materials that went in to make that building.
Oh.
He was very proficient at that. And there are many buildings in the Twin Cities that he worked on because of all his part would be. And
so, like, the various, like, carpets and finishes on wood or woodwork, that kind of?
Oh, no, the building.
Yeah.
The steel, the wood, the brick,
okay,
the windows,
right. Gotcha.
Everything. And that was his ability. And when we first got married, I thought we had too much orange and blue. And once we got into a home where I could work a little bit more, I finally got it to my color scheme, and he loved it. More blue and white.
Yeah.
I just felt more comfortable.
Interesting.
And I think he did too. But when I met him at the U, I was also involved in Union Board of Governors, which is the seat of Kauffman Union, the place where everybody goes.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, oh, that's Cheers. Well,
yeah.
That's from Cheers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was involved in decorating with big panels. They had dances in their ballroom. Mm-hmm. And I did it all myself. I painted everything myself.
Yeah.
But they had to have big decorations to have there.
Yeah.
So I did that while I was at Kauffman.
Wonder, do any pictures exist of those dances with those artworks? I wonder if...
I've got one picture. My father, Kimo, he was always checking what I was doing, and he came over and took a picture of me up the ladder in the ceiling. I don't know.
Wow.
I didn't tell you this. While I was at the U, I made a good friend, but he didn't show up in one semester. So I asked him, called him, or he called me, because we dated occasionally, what happened? And he said, oh, I got my job. And he told me what it was. And I said, oh my gosh, that sounds like fun. Would I ever love to do that? And he said, well, they're looking for somebody in this huge department store to do all of the main floor level interior designs with the merchandise. I said, oh, that sounds like fun. He said, why don't you come over and see if they want to hire you? Which I did. I don't know if I told my folks this.
Yeah.
But I was always on my own crusade anyhow, and I did. They hired me, and I said, I got to quit the U. I've got a dream job. Great. And that's what took me away from the U and set me right where I needed to be with all these dramatic people that did this work. And there were only two girls in the department. But I loved doing that. It was finally big enough and so much to do. And then you could see what the other people were doing.
Yeah.
And then we'd work on conglomerate things, like they had huge exhibitions that took a lot of work and money and size. But I loved that so much. Then Jim got drafted in the Army, and I followed him.
Okay.
That's how that progressed.
This is what,
because that was my big hurrah.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
then.
Interior store design and.
It was wonderful, and I didn't. I got married while I was there, but I didn't have family or a house to take care of. I could just concentrate on what I was doing. It was freedom.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved it. And nobody came and told me what I had to do.
Amazing.
Just fix it. Do it.
Yeah.
And this is what you're working with.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved the freedom of it.
Well, wasn't there a note, too, that you were part of a Chroma Club?
The Chroma Club. Well, now we're going back to high school. That was the artists in high school. I think they were all artists. They were all in art classes. Mm-hmm. And that's how they came about with that exceptional art teacher. She's the organizer of it. Because we needed an adult, you know.
Right, for an official
but,
club.
But she would take us on tours of the Art Institute, and we would look at paintings and discuss them. It was quicker than going through a book.
Right.
And seeing it, you know, face to face.
See the real thing.
And that interested me so much that when I got around to doing a lot of oil painting with another person, and they set up tulips in a bouquet, and I was asked if I would use a palette knife on it. And somebody who was so used to keeping in the lines and doing everything right, I thought, that's an awful lot of freedom. But did I love that palette knife, because I couldn't control it. It had more freedom.
Yeah.
And to get things in the right place, doing the right thing, I loved it.
Yeah.
And that was a new experience.
Yeah, that's amazing. A lot of people think that not having control is a problem, but it's actually free. It's freeing.
See, that's why I'm not much in watercolor. It is the looseness in a painting that I love.
Yeah.
And you could tell that it was dried, or wet, and then dried, and the other. I love to look at one and take it apart a little bit.
Yeah, you can see the marks being made and imagine it's so how the person made it.
So original.
Yeah.
It is original. I am attracted to anything that's handmade. Right. Baskets. I wanted to learn how baskets were made.
Yeah.
I've seen people walk past baskets they wouldn't pick up, but I see it and I knew that it was made by somebody holding tiny reeds or weeds or something to make it. I even have a pin cushion, a little one like this, that is woven in that Nantucket style of the baskets. Mm. Tiny, tiny little reeds went into that.
Yeah.
I just looked at it and I had to have that. Yeah. So I said, Jim, I have to have that. Jim bought it. But it's so much fun to visit with you.
Oh, it's interesting for me to learn all this because, I don't know, it's like that artist mentality.
Oh, is that just, it?
Well, I associate
that. That
ain't
one of you.
Well, that, because you spoke about using a palette knife because it's freeing and being, you know, having that artistic side or...
I have artistic sides.
Yeah.
I've got three great grandchildren that are showing it immensely. And the one is 8.
Okay.
And he's doing specific articulate things by hand.
Yeah.
And color them. I've got a frame this big that's hanging in my room.
Hmm.
And I said, I want you to sign that because someday you're going to be famous.
Yeah.
He's very artistic. And then he did a sketch of the birth of Jesus with all in pen. It's he just not erasing or anything.
Right.
It's a sketch, free sketch. That's in a frame at my room.
Hmm.
Then another great-granddaughter knew I liked pansies. She watercolored pansies in a vase for a gift. Just sent me the paper in a frame.
Nice.
I've got those things hanging in my room, along with my bib with the 3 buttons on it.
Hmm. Well, and you mentioned, too, this teacher that you had who ran the Chroma Club. That I'll have to look up when acrylic paints were invented, because she brought them to your class saying this is a new material, acrylic paints.
See, in the 40s.
Yeah, I think so.
It was the 40s.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up, the exact date of when it all kind of came together, but it is a relatively recent
probably
invention.
About 46.
Yeah. But kind of painting a picture of a person who, at a very young age, would envision, like, painting their room black. Well, it strikes me as, like, you've been making artwork and the goal has been all along to, like, share it with other people or to be out in the community doing things. It strikes me more like you're the type of person who looked for ways so that your work was, like, public. Like either, you know, setting up for a dance at Kauffman Union or the work that you did with a department store in Minneapolis doing store design and layout, basically, right? Is that?
Yeah.
And
organize my time.
Like a massive sculpture made up of the whole inside of a store or showroom. And then... painting the kid's car next door and
that was fun.
Just kind of being out in the community and, you know, organizing like fundraisers for a children's hospital.
Yes.
Seems like you've used your artwork to connect with people your whole life, so it makes sense that you would have a view of how important it is and how bad it is that people are being isolated and how that affects people.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. please share it with your friends and family who may be interested, and follow Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast, on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you if you have comments or suggestions. I'd like to thank Jeremy Shapinski for writing and performing the theme music. Thank you also to Grant Winkles, Susie Manili, and Jeremy Shapinski again for their production, consulting, and editing.